Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's, yeah, they have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you want?
I'd like to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm good to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
Ireland weren't playing this weekend, and yet it feels like we've taken a pretty big step towards qualification this morning after Denmark's nil-all draw away to Georgia last night. It means basically that if we beat Georgia away and don't lose against Denmark and Switzerland, we're going to go through. Ken Early said that 4 draws against the best 2 teams in the group won't get the job done, but it turns out it might bloody well do it after all. And depending on how the Denmark-Switzerland game goes, next month, the same night we play Georgia away, 3 draws against Switzerland and Denmark might be enough. Welcome to a very happy Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hello there, Ken.
Hello. What, 3 draws could be enough?
If we can afford to lose one of those games, if Switzerland beat Denmark.
If Switzerland beat Denmark, then we can lose to
Switzerland, and a draw against Denmark will get us through.
You've worked that out, have you?
I have indeed.
You're prepared to go to bat for that? I haven't worked it out.
I'd say that we can start packing our bags now, but we're hosting this jamboree, of course. Ken, what a time to be alive. We're Euro 2020 pretty much main hosts. All of the big games are happening here, right?
Some of the games will happen here.
Okay. This was an excellent result for us last night, Ken.
Yes, it really was. And not for the first time, Georgia coming through for us. They did it to Bulgaria in the 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking about Dion Fanning, said they got invaded by Russia as well. Don't forget that. got invaded by Russia.
So that we could play them
in
Germany.
Mainz.
Yeah.
We played them at Jurgen Klopp's Mainz.
Yeah.
In 2008, beat them.
Mm-hmm. Glenn Whelan, screamer.
Glenn Whelan got a goal.
Deflected.
I think it was a deflected free kick.
Yeah. Screamer in my head. Okay, I've neatly edited out the deflection.
They did it then, of course, to...
They do it to everyone except us, basically.
No, they did it. They did it to us last time. But they, in the most recent qualifiers, so it was Bulgaria 2010. It was Scotland in the 2016 qualifiers, mm-hmm. when it looked as though we weren't going to make it, and then Scotland managed to lose in Georgia, I think, either lost or drew, and now they've done it to Denmark. And all I can say is thank you.
Mm. I mean, every country should have a Georgia.
Everyone,
you know,
wishes
someone
they
just
had.
Wandering around in your group, taking out teams, but, you know, also not being that difficult for us to roll them over.
Well, you know, I mean, they have outplayed us a few times.
Oh yeah.
They have outplayed us.
I wouldn't, you know, that game.
I mean, we obviously won the one there with Aidan McGeady scoring a couple of goals, mm-hmm. and that was like... they totally outplayed us.
That was daylight robbery of the first water.
And that's not the only time that's happened. But we go there in good heart. We go there next month in good heart and full of gratitude. for what the Georgian people have accomplished.
As Ireland's qualifying campaign rumbles to a crescendo over the next couple of months, there truly is no better time to be a Second Captains World Service member. And if that just seems a little too medium term for you, then how about an interview with world's hottest author, TM, Michael Owen, coming up for you on the World Service this coming Friday. To join, just go to secondcaptains.com/join. It's €5 a month plus VAT with no contract, no obligation to stay beyond 1 month. And we'd love to have you. Now, time for a report on sport, please. You were in Abbottstown again today, Ken. It was in Abbottstown, was it, the press conference?
Yep. Yes, I was out there to see Mick McCarthy and Seamus Coleman. Not sure if Seamus Coleman's actually going to play. I mean, he said himself, I'm the captain of the team. He wanted me to come to the press conference. But the theme of this press conference was, obviously, this game is a lot more low-key than the previous one in that it doesn't, it's a friendly, it's not a consequential game, and we're going to see a different type of Ireland team. So that's what was Mick McCarthy asked. Obviously, there was things to talk about this time. The result in Denmark, what do you think? Obviously, it's better for us than if Denmark had won. You know, he didn't want to be like, yes, this was great, celebrating, you know, that'll teach the Danes. It wasn't like that. It was
maybe
just,
they should stop running their mouths quite so much.
But we were, you know, we were all sat watching it over dinner. We were all delighted. But I think it just reemphasizes what a good side Georgia are as well. You know?
I think any of the Irish players who have played against Georgia over the last couple of years have a fairly good idea that Georgia are pretty decent.
They're decent. Well, you know, can we go there and win? Mick McCarthy was asked. I was never going to try anything else, Tony, said Mick. It has not changed our approach. I knew they were a good side. I think yesterday they looked like the team at the end of it that might have nicked it. This was in Georgia-Denmark.
They whacked the crossbar a couple of times, didn't they?
Yes, they hit it late on, I think. Bulgaria. Oh, yeah. Have you decided on the team for today against Bulgaria? I have, yes. I will be telling them this morning. Shape. I'm working on shape, free kicks, and corners. So, will you be bringing in any new players to the team, Mick? Yes. It's an opportunity to see them play. For those that have travelled around in support of the rest of the lads, for them to get a game. We have lost two strikers. That's Robinson and McGoldrick have both gone back to Sheffield United with various knocks. Collins and Hogan will both start. They will both play, says Mick. So there's the strikers confirmed, Collins and Hogan. Did you think about calling in any under-21s? Don't know if you saw any of the Ireland under-21s against Armenia, but
I saw the goal. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, the goal was pretty tasty.
It looks as though Ireland under-21s are coming good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's the manager of that team again?
Well, he's going to be the next manager of the Ireland senior international team. I mean, it is only a 1-0 win against Armenia under-21. You know, it's not like...
Still, though, the goal, Ken, the goal. Aaron Connolly.
It was a
racing down the wing.
It was a very nice goal. Have they... he said, so, Mick has asked, have you thought about calling in any of these players? Haven't they got a qualifier tomorrow? Yes. Then why on earth would I call them in? The under-21s are playing Sweden tomorrow in their qualifying group. That would be wrong of me. The under-21s want to qualify for the competition. I was impressed by Connolly. Thought he was the pick of the bunch. Malumbi as well. Having a soft spot for centre-backs. I like the pair of them. They can play. This is all mixed views. Isn't the point of... but then he was asked, isn't the point of, you know, under-21s football to develop players for the senior team? I mean, if you look at Robbie Keane, Damien Duff, they kind of skipped that phase, went straight into the team. And he said, yes, strangely enough, we might qualify for the Euros and they might be playing there. You know, I see them as... Mick says, I'm not sure if I played them again in a friendly against Bulgaria. Will it tell me that they can compete in a game against Georgia or against Denmark at home? A competitive, basically, they'll learn more from playing a competitive game against Sweden than they would from playing in a friendly with the senior team against Bulgaria.
Yeah. I mean, it is a kind of a weird situation where Mick McCarthy could hamstring the ambition of Stephen Kenny, no doubt, with the Ireland under-21s is to win games at that level. So it would be a little weird. I mean, it's just another weird offshoot of this weird scenario where we picked two managers to do the job over the course of 3 years.
Well, it's not going to happen anyway. Not in this case. You know, if it was not a big qualifier for the under-21s, then who knows what would happen then. But Seamus Coleman asked, you know, familiar foes, Georgia? Yes. He mentioned the word difficult about six times. Makes it more difficult. We know how difficult it is. Scotland found it difficult as players. We knew that. Everyone knows how difficult it is to go to Georgia. Good place. Difficult place to go as well. Everyone knows how difficult it is to go to Georgia. So are you playing tomorrow? Nah, look, I'm the captain. The side manager wanted me here. Whether I play or don't play, it's important. The players are traveling, who are traveling everywhere with us. If the manager does change it, we're a team and a family. Whoever plays, we will support them. You know, whoever plays will want to win the game. Da, 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 da. They can stake their claim, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I mean, Enda Stevens is suspended, so...
We should have a look at our options at left-back, Ken.
What will the left-back...
Has anyone thought of this idea yet, no?
What will the left-back be?
Mix thought of it, right.
Well, it won't be James McClain. Somebody asked me about playing him there. I said, why would I? He doesn't see McClain as a left-back anyway. He talked about how...
He might have seen that Leeds game that you saw as well.
Well, I'm sure he did. I mean, from James McClain's positioning in the game the other night, you'd think he was kind of had that Leeds game in his head as well. When Stuart Dallas got around the outside of him, he was kind of playing tucked so far back that like it was as though he was determined not to let something like that happen again. Mm. Anyway, it won't be him. Who it will be? Well, I know the answer, but I can't reveal it. I can't reveal it due to the incompetence of me and other members of broadcast media in failing to nail down this issue. We didn't get the answer that Mick only provided after the embargo cut off.
Okay.
So in order, if you want to find, Mick did say who it was going to be, but in order to find out, you will have to either wait until 11 p.m. or contact personally one of the people who work on the dailies, an Irish football journalist. If you happen to know one, you can get the answer. I couldn't give it to you.
And they actually do answer their phones at Irish newspapers still. So if you want to ring up the newspapers themselves, demand to be put through to... Is this what you're asking people to do?
Or no, I'm not asking... No, I'm just saying...
Ring the Irish Independent and ask for Danny McDonald. Don't get off the phone until you're speaking to Danny McDonald.
If you're lucky enough to know Danny, he might reveal the information. He may not. At the end of this press conference... this is after the embargo point, but also after the point at which the press conference finished. So I think I can report that Mick McCarthy said, I've told the player, he didn't say exactly that, he said the name of the player.
Yeah.
I've told the player he's playing. So you can tweet that if you like, to be shouted, to be greeted by shouts of, no, you can't. From the daily newspaper journalists who still wish to retain this information for the 11 p.m. embargo. So... I'm sorry. And look, I'm sorry, but these are rules. Is my duty to the truth?
It sounds like it's reasonably newsworthy anyway.
It was by far the most interesting part of the press conference.
Oh,
look, it was really good. And who's my duty to? Is my duty to the listeners? Is my duty to the public? Is it my duty to the truth? My duty is to...
The embargo.
The rules of my profession.
Okay.
My first loyalty is to the conventions of my guild. I you know, whatever about the attitude of my colleagues out in Qatar. I can't say.
Okay.
What can I say? You know?
Okay, well,
come back.
That's two minutes of our listeners' lives they're not getting back.
It won't be Matt Doherty. He's not in the squad.
Okay.
But could it be him for the match next month in Georgia? Because, I mean, the whole point of this is Enda Stevens has been left back and he can't play that match because he's suspended. So the suspension can't be used up, unfortunately, in this friendly. Has to be a competitive game.
Yes.
So what could be happening, notwithstanding what happens tomorrow, what could be happening when Matt Doherty comes in? Well, he played about two seasons at left back for Wolves, said Mick. So, of course, he's a consideration. Let's hope he's fit and his knee is okay. You know, essentially he's saying... he said Stephen Ward, I know him, Greg Cunningham, I don't need to see any of these play to road test them. Whoever plays tomorrow,
fucking any chance of you training?
Whoever plays tomorrow, it might be a surprise, we'll wait and see. That was what he said before the embargo, right? Okay, so he said he didn't need to see Stephen Ward or Greg Cunningham, he knows all about them in that position. So what else? What else do you want to see from side? Oh, it's always nice to see the side win. So hopefully that I'd like to see the players give me the problem I've spoken about with the under-21s. That is, if the players are giving me, as manager, a dilemma. Oh, should I pick them? Should I put this player in the squad or in the team?
That sounds terrible, Mick. And yet you want to be put in this position? You're volunteering yourself for this tragedy? No.
How do you mean?
The idea that, I mean, surely it should be much easier for Mick if we just had 11 good players and he could pick the team.
No, he wants competition.
He wants suffering. Okay.
Look at them and think, so hopefully everyone sees that. How do you assess the challenge of Bulgaria? Well, you know, obviously they played England the other day. England made it look pretty easy in a 4-0 victory. England, they're a very good side. Mick said, I don't know if Bulgaria just tried to contain them and were well beaten. Actually, somebody told me the best players they've got are in the 21s. They've been taken out of the seniors and put into the under-21s. Interesting concept that if I took the players and stopped the under-21s, there'd be yells and screams of, why did I do it? Bizarre.
Oh, so he's kind of returned to this under-21 thing quite a bit.
Yeah. It's like, you know, he was kind of like, you know, people are all, oh, you should bring in players, blood, youth and all this. But then they'd be like, oh, what about the under-21s, Mick? Like, you know, I can't win. That seemed to be his thing. If the under-21s didn't have a qualifier, would you be tempted to bring them in? Yes, said Mick, and then sat there looking back at the person who asked the question, and who was kind of like,
yes, you'd be tempted to, but then wouldn't, or yes, you would do?
That was a pretty categoric answer, said Mick. I don't think I can put any more meat on the bones for that. So the answer is yes, he would. However, they do have a qualifier, and therefore he won't, not this time. So that was that was today's press conference.
Any other hints of change of shape? I know we were talking about 3-5-2 a bit on Friday.
No, it will be
4-3-3.
Well, it won't be. It'll be. He's picking a left back, so I deduce from this that it will be. Okay. I can't reveal who that left back is, but I can deduce from the fact that there is a left back in the team. It must be a flat back four. It must be a flat back four. You don't have a left back if you've got three central defenders. You get a left wing back. Mick knows the difference between those things. So, you know, that's, I imagine, flat back four, probably the same shape. What's the point in trying a completely random shape as well as a bunch of new players? I mean, you're trying to see how players do in the kind of established roles in the team, I guess.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean,
you know,
just if you're talking about the level of changes that he's hinting at there, all of the players who travel with us, I mean, they don't bring 14 on these trips. Like, they're, you know, it sounds like he's going to make 7 or 8 changes at least.
I think so. So yeah, I mean, which at least is something interesting to look at in a friendly, in the sense of, well, you know, who else have you got? Can anyone really put in an outstanding performance and be like, well, maybe this guy should be in there? Okay, what else is going on? Well, Granit Xhaka apparently is going to take a break from international football. When is he going to take this small break? In the middle of October, apparently.
But wait a minute, Kent. Hold your horses just for 1 second.
15th of October.
That would be the middle of October in my mind. If you ask me for a date that suggests the middle of October, I would say the 15th of October. And what's this? Switzerland against the Republic of Ireland, Stade de Genève, Geneva.
15th of October. This is because his wife is going to have a baby. So the Sun have reported that he is going to take a little break. And this is sort of an interesting one, because it seems like it's not just I want to be there for the birth. It's like I want to take a little bit of paternity leave to kind of.
They're playing Denmark on the 12th of October in Copenhagen in a game that we'd actually like Switzerland to win. So, I mean, if you wanted to take a break, absolutely fine anytime after the, you know, 13th of October.
He wants to, yeah, once he becomes a father, just to, you know, it's a big moment in anyone's life. It's something that's crept into the game, this paternity stuff, you know?
I mean, I'm trying to think of the Swiss Graham Souness, but like...
He just might be better off staggering that parental leave.
Take a couple of days off every week for 6 months, rather than take a big lump of parental leave.
Yeah.
Because the early days aren't actually...
Very interesting. They're not hard and...
Get them home, get them relaxed, boring. Then go back into the office for a couple of...
Xhaka may be on this break, I guess, by the time Ireland play Switzerland. I mean, we don't know if Shaqiri's going to be back, because Shaqiri decided not to play in these matches, although he could have. I mean, you've seen him in the Liverpool matchday squads, although not playing. Mm. He kind of referred to a sort of groin problem that he has. But it seems as though what he was really saying was, I want to concentrate on getting fit for my club and these national team games, important qualifiers though they may be, I'm going to sit them out. So, which is a bit of a, you know, it's not great from the Swiss point of view. Petkovic, the manager, didn't look super delighted when he was being asked to talk about it the other night. And now he's got another player who...
These two games will define... Like, they're it's Denmark away, us at home for Switzerland. And a guy deciding just to, you know, I'm just not going to play. What's I don't know when the baby's going to be born, but regardless, I'm just not.
Well, okay, first of all, he hasn't said that he's not going to play. It's just that apparently, according to a report, in the Sun, he has declared it an intention to take a short break from football around this time. So, obviously, there's no, you can't say for sure, all I know is the baby is supposed to be due in mid-October. That babies don't always arrive bang on the due date. And who knows how long his break is going to be. I don't know if it's going to include the Ireland game. It's just an interesting thing that he, I guess it could theoretically rule him out if it happens, if the cookie crumbles that way. What else is going on? An amazing performance by Henrik Mkhitaryan, Shaka's former team. Shaka actually had a quote about the North London derby. Oh, people only want to talk about my mistake for the penalty. Okay, but what about all the chances we missed? Like, it wasn't just your mistake. He committed 7 fouls or some insane number like this. It was ridiculous what he was doing out there. But also featuring in that North London derby and what was, it turned out, his last game for Arsenal's Henrik Mkhitaryan. He's gone to Roma since then. And he was back home in Armenia playing against Bosnia. And it looked like an absolutely amazing game. You had Bosnia, who obviously are a decent enough side. I mean, we managed to beat them in the playoffs for the Euros. Edin Dzeko is still there. This sort of immortal Edin Dzeko was leading the line for them. Starts off, first goal was Mkhitaryan. Nice little take in the box and kind of rounds the keeper and whacks it into the empty net. Dzeko responds with a goal like, a low hard cross. Dzeko arriving, slams it into the net from 4 or 5 yards, you know, Terminator. He's like a foot, he looks like a foot taller than everybody else around him. So second half, Mkhitaryan again down the right channel, gets into the box, absolutely smashes the ball over the head of the goalkeeper into the roof of the net. 2-1, brilliant goal. But only a couple of minutes later, another low cross into the box, Dzeko again, bang, Terminator 2-0. Very frustrating. I mean, Mkhitaryan's given it his everything here, but just this guy just keeps coming back. Just can't check this guy off.
Why won't you die?
Well, this time it comes out to Mkhitaryan on the left. Left-footed cross, first time, and curling beautifully into the path of the onrushing Armenian right-back who smashes it in. This is another great thing about this game. So many of the goals were just ripping into the net.
Good.
Bang, into the net. 3-2. Yeah, huge celebrations for everybody. And then just as Bosnia, you know, Dzeko is trying. He's trying to do what he's been doing. But now the ball comes to Mkhitaryan.
Reanimate the game.
Left channel this time. Does a little step over. Beats the defender. And then as he's closing in, the angle, it looks too narrow. But oh, what's this? He's only gone and used the defender who's backtracking to the goal line as a kind of a cone to knock the ball into the net off. Yes, he did that deliberately. It goes down as a no goal. But we all know what that really was. 4-2. And
are you sure he meant to cannon the ball?
Well, I mean, there was no one else there. I mean, it looked that way. It was like he's actually gone and used the defender there to score his goal off that cross. Fair play to him, because there was no teammate in the vicinity.
Good football tense use there, by the way.
And
he's
gone and used it. Yeah. And then Edin Dzeko, head bowed, look, red light just dims to a dot. And it's all over. So Armenia
now I know why you cry.
Armenia are now looking like they will qualify for this tournament, part of which... let's remind ourselves, it's being held in Baku, which is the venue that got such rave reviews from Arsenal and Chelsea fans of the Europa League final, and where, of course, Henrik Mkhitaryan couldn't go because he's Armenian. I mean, obviously...
Baku, Azerbaijan.
Azerbaijan,
Armenia.
All their guys all insisted, look,
it's
of
fun.
Course you can come here. Yeah. Of course you can. It's just that he felt he couldn't believe that. So now it could be the entire Armenian squad qualifying for this. I mean, when UEFA obviously didn't think too much about the Europa League final, in the sense that, like, what are the odds there's going to be an Armenian in the final? I mean, it's basically only if Mkhitaryan's team. Oh, Mkhitaryan.
Yeah, they're there. Yeah.
Whereas this is obviously, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess they'll have to rig the draw if it works out that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, and this happens in a number of situations with qualification groups and stuff like that. Teams are kept apart from each other and all the rest. But, I mean, it is pretty ridiculous. Well, obviously, one of the teams that qualify can't play in our whole city because, you know, they don't like each other. It's pretty daft.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, Armenia, they've still got a ways to go. I mean, they've got to play Liechtenstein. You'd imagine they can win that. And they've got to play Greece, who have been really bad, and Italy is their last game. That's the Italy are top of the group, having won all their six matches so far. The big one is against Finland. They're away to Finland in mid-October, the same day that we play Switzerland. So if they win that, then they're probably going to qualify. And then we'll see how UEFA are going to structure that draw. But what else is going on? Germany lost 4-2 at home to Holland. Holland obviously getting, they lost the home game, but have managed to beat Germany again in Germany. Gini Wijnaldum had an absolutely brilliant game in this, scored a goal.
I saw a wonder assist, yes.
Yeah, great, where he looked like he was going to shoot and then just kind of dinked the ball the other direction. Joachim Löw seems to be taking some heat now. In the national team, you just can't change everything from one day to the next. He says, this is the guy who, remember, purged Mats Hummels, Jerome Boateng, and Thomas Müller all in one big go. And now he's saying, hey.
Rome wasn't built in a day.
Yeah, gradually. We do these things gradually. And everyone's kind of like, well, you know, I mean, you took quite a radical approach. But, like, he seems to be saying sort of it's up to the players now to do it. I mean, it's interesting how fast these things move on. You know, if you look at the German team now, really is a bit light on kind of, you know, the sort of quality that they had 5 years ago when they won the World Cup just isn't really there anymore. You know, Serge Gnabry, Marco Reus, Timo Werner. I mean, Reus is an excellent player, but, like, he has had a lot of problems injury-wise. Kroos and Kimmich in midfield. I mean, Joshua Kimmich is still kind of being used there. They're playing kind of a 3-4-3, you know. I don't
Timo
know.
Timo Werner.
Really. Oh, it's a wonderful game what we are playing here.
I don't think Lothar would. I actually would be interested just to hear what stuff Lothar had to say about it. I haven't seen what he said about it, but I can imagine. I think I can probably.
I seem to recall tweeting about Timo Werner during the World Cup saying that he was giving the worst performance that I had ever seen, and I'd seen Ireland play Oman numerous times.
He had one of those.
It was. I can't remember the exact game.
You're just like, how did you actually make it? And, you know, the thing about him is, like, he's, you know, what he seems to me to be very characteristic of the type of player that's produced by, you know, German academies. Like, he's got a lot of skills at, like, an 8 out of 10 level, you know? And I just kind of feel like he's missing some extra dimension of quality that a really good, like, a top level Germany international striker would have. Like, he's fast, but, like, not really fast. Like, he's skillful, but not super skillful. You know, he's decent. He'd get in the Ireland team.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we'd be delighted with him.
But, yeah, you know, so Holland have kind of turned it around since their own pretty bad experience. So what else of the last couple of years? I mean, they've failed to make the last couple of tournaments, which is a disgrace for them. So what else? Yeah, just mentioned England. We're going to talk to Miguel about he was at Wembley to see them, hat trick for Harry Kane. He revealed that he sometimes does 50 penalties in practice at a time, which sounded almost a bit Johnny Wilkinson-ish. 50 is a lot, isn't it? It's 50. I suppose, you know, he is pretty good at penalties. I mean,
just, you know, Sky Sports, they do kind of flash up that graphic of where your last 5 penalties gone. I mean, it's not that difficult to figure out if there's a discernible pattern in one's. I mean, you do have to be able to put the ball in a lot of different positions.
Yeah.
So keepers aren't on top of your game.
He denied ever diving. I've never dived. Hopefully I don't have to, he says, which seems to reserve the possibility that he might. In extremis,
if I do dive, it'll be someone else's fault, is what that sounds like to me, Harry.
I said after the Arsenal game, it's a 50-50 one. You hear Xhaka is complaining about, people are still complaining about this. Well, you know, Kane was accused of diving after I thought it was a penalty myself. He says it's 50-51, similar to the one we got given against us at Wembley the year before. It happens in football. I'm someone who uses his body well, which as a striker you have to do at every level. On the halfway line, it's a free kick every day of the week. In the penalty box, you don't always get it. People's opinions are their opinions. So I tend to agree with him there, although not so much with his I've never dived. I think he understands sometimes that the referee needs a little bit of help if he's going to give those. As he says, it's harder to get a foul given in your favour in the penalty area than on the halfway line. Sometimes you've just got to make sure people have seen it. And I think he's definitely done that. The other thing I just want to mention is just before the weekend, there was something we didn't have time to talk about last week, was Rupert Lowe's interview with Jack Pitbrook. Remarkable stuff. Rupert Lowe, the former Southampton chairman, is now a Brexit Party MEP and a prospective parliamentary candidate. I'm not sure if that's actually been confirmed yet. But he's going to be running for the Brexit Party, it looks like, in the forthcoming general election. He proudly tweeted this interview, talking about two of my great passions, football and politics. English football is a good metaphor for the country as a whole, he says. You're already thinking, what? We have fantastic talent, but we are held back by a Remain establishment. Let's look beyond Europe's borders and go global. Like, what is he talking about? What is he talking about? We're held back by a Remain establishment. What is he talking about?
Yeah, I really don't think the Premier League is the example you want to be raising here, Rupert.
The Premier League is a Remain establishment. That is true. I'm not sure that it's necessarily held English football back. I mean, they do have the current European champions. Mm. And in terms of look beyond Europe's borders, they...
Let's talk about six.
Well, it was Mane, Firmino and Salah. You know what I mean? Like, it seems to me as though a lot of the things he's talking about that he'd like to see done are in fact already possible in the current setup. But anyway, the interesting thing about this isn't so much what he said in his tweet promoting this interview. It's what he said in the interview itself. He says, the key to club and English football is to improve the quality and structure of our coaching. If we get the right people instilling not only the right skills, but also the right moral basis into these people, I think we really have got the ability to win World Cups, because I am absolutely convinced, having looked at it, that we have the best raw material. So Jack Pitbrook says, what do you mean by raw material? The best players. Our stock of players. Our people from the Northeast, Yorkshire. Our strong bloodstock. You shouldn't really call people bloodstock, but that's what you're talking about, because you're talking about an industry. If you studied football in France, you tend to find a lot of the best French players come from the Camargue. It's a region of France. You've got very tough, mentally strong people, physically strong people. It's quite similar here. The Camargue produces very, very good players. The Camargue is like a little corner of France down by down in the neck of the woods of Marseille. I guess maybe Eric Cantona is from there.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know.
I'm just a little concerned about the general point, though.
I don't know if Eric Cantona is actually from the Camargue or, in fact, Marseille, which is not too far away from there. But okay. But, I mean, just in relation to the specific point about France, as Jack puts him, don't the best French players tend to come from kind of the Paris suburbs these days? You know, that sort of...
Thierry Henry,
the multicultural Paris suburbs.
Paul Pogba.
He mentions Pogba. Pogba's originally not from France, is he? Said Rupert Lowe. He would be from Africa. As Jack points out, Pogba was born in Lagny-sur-Marne, an eastern suburb of Paris. Okay, but you know, I don't think that really changes Rupert Lowe's argument very much. Mm. Do you?
No. I don't think Rupert is going to go, you know what? I'm mistaken. I misspoke. Completely there.
Yeah, I think he might.
If he was born in France, then that obviously makes him French, and that's the end of the matter.
Well, you know, like the idea that that skills in football or ability in sports somehow comes from like the blood and the bones and the hardy bloodstock, and like he's talking about people like they're sheep. You know what I mean? Like this particular hardy type of sheep that lives in the mountains and look as hard as nails. You know what I mean? Like football ability is not in the blood, It's not in the blood. It's not in the physique either. Like, the two greatest players of my lifetime are both, in the terms that Rupert Lowe would use, are both little hardy Shetland ponies from Argentina, right? You wouldn't cast your eye at a Mart, right? When you're going around slapping the flanks of the various, slapping the flanks of the sportsmen. If you want to buy some sportsmen for your youth academy, and you're inspecting them, looking in their mouth and all this kind of stuff, you wouldn't pick out those two Argentine Shetland ponies as, oh, these guys are 100% derby winners. And yet they are, you know, in football. Because it's not something that comes from, like, your DNA or, like, what part of the, or I don't know, some what Lamarckian evolution that Rupert Lowe believes in. It's something that comes from the culture. You know, it's like, it depends. Did you grow up in an area where there were also lots of kids who played football? Then the chances are that you might be better at football than somebody who grew up on a mountain in Yorkshire. You know, running up and down the dales, uphill and down dale, lungs, massive lungs, filled with clean mountain air. As long as you aren't too close to the,
you know, the major conurbations,
nuclear processing plant they've just got tucked in next to the Lake District there. But look, it's about, it, like, where the best players come from. They come from usually densely populated cities. I mean, today it's London and Paris in Europe are the two places where most that have the highest sort of proportion of the highest number of players coming out of them. I mean, you've seen places like Buenos Aires, Montevideo, that whole region produces lots of football players. Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro. But between the wars here, like we were talking to Jonathan Wilson about his Hungarian book, Budapest and Vienna, the big cities where lots of immigrants, lots of children. They're the conditions in which football players sprout. It's nothing to do with, like, their bloodstock.
Maybe if you approached Rupert Lowe and said, you know,
How does Rupert Lowe explain the terrible New Zealand or Canadian football team? I mean, we're not talking about hardy bloodstock here in the sense in which he means. You know, your Edmund Hillary's.
Yeah.
Carried to the top by
Tenzing Norgay.
Look, he knew how to work as part of a team.
He did.
He had the teamwork. That was also in his blood.
Yep.
Like, just such absolute nonsense. Like, this
but
guy...
But surely Rupert would be very much... I mean, if you went to him with your Buenos Aires suggestion, surely Rupert would be delighted to then ferry over thousands of Buenos Aires inhabitants and get them breeding somewhere in Yorkshire.
Oh, God.
Set up a stable. Is that what Rupert's talking about?
I hope not. Just look at the fetlocks on Milner. You know? Look at the conformation of Jordan Henderson's musculature. This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway, and he also throws in a bunch of stuff about how basically the BBC is a bunch of, you know, the Remainers, and, you know, this all the stuff about shortages is scaremongering, and finishes off by saying we actually hold all the cards, but our establishment appears to have completely lost the plot. This is the brass button blazer millionaire Englishman speaking to Jack Pitbrook of The Athletic in the Ritz last week or the week before. So that was the view from there.
Miguel Delaney of The Independent coming up in just a moment.
Beaver made a movie recently.
Did they? John Delaney could run anything.
They did, actually.
About themselves?
Yeah, about themselves.
God, that's ego, isn't it? He could run FIFA. Certainly better than Sepp Blatter.
Yeah, that's incredible, Eagle, but the real movie's on its way.
Well, yeah, I'm off to see the Queen tomorrow too, don't forget that.
No, don't forget that.
In 2009, I called him an embarrassment to FIFA and an embarrassment to himself, and I said it to him across the table, just like I'm talking to you. We wanted two expletives. He said, no one speaks to me like that.
And you said?
And I said, well, I do. And that was it. We wanted two expletives. And I just asked her to move on. It was an extraordinary moment. She was here to tell you, just stared at her for 7 or 8 seconds, and I said, move on now, please. And then he moved. When I went in and told him how I felt about him, there were some expletive views, we came to an agreement.
It's a very good agreement for FBI.
And you've used the figure there. Well done to you.
Miguel, while the rest of us were watching Ireland march towards Euro 2020, you were at Wembley watching England march towards Euro 2020. Do you think that you were watching the Euro 2020 champions?
They're probably a little bit short still. I think, like, they've made huge progress over the last few years. I think it's, I mean, it might be difficult for a lot of people to accept this, but I think they are probably one of the top 5-6 sides in the world now. I think they still have an issue in midfield, but I suppose the wider thing is, and the wider discussion is, that no matter what midfield he puts out, I almost feel that that detail is actually irrelevant to the vast majority of their games, which could actually be one thing that kind of stops it. Southgate was talking about this after the game on Saturday, about basically how so many of their games are now so easy. They don't really have competition for those games that really test them. The kind of these matches against the top 8 sides in the world, where they kind of where they have fallen short.
Has he forgotten the Nations League already? I mean, you know, how many of these games do you want?
He referenced that and said that basically they haven't had a test like the Nations Leagues in any of the games since then. Well, it's just two now, to be fair. But he said, but most of their qualification games haven't been like that. And he talked about how they have to keep the tension up or kind of tightness in training, because a lot of the games have been lacking it. And like, I don't think this wasn't coming from a usual, or I suppose maybe the historically arrogant perspective many would have thought from England. I mean, Southgate's kind of playing it quite straight, and I think it's difficult to dispute that.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the wider discussion.
Yeah, I mean, the wider discussion is, you know, England are going to be playing a lot of games at home. It's going to be a big thing next summer. But will you be allowed to stick around to cover it? I mean, have you got your papers in order? Have you work permit, residence, permanent residency? Miguel Delaney, I'm saying, is it just sounds a bit suspect. You know, if I'm a customs official, I might be thinking, call that guy into the other queue. I mean, what is the situation?
we're all good. We've been assured of our status, so no problems our end, despite my first name.
Okay. Okay, well, that's reassuring. What was Southgate saying?
He was essentially just talking about it's trying to kind of perfect the team so that they're at the level of the Dutch, the Germans, maybe less so the Germans a bit now, Spain, France, but it's quite difficult to do that in the current context, and part of that is because, I mean, it was one thing I was thinking when I was doing my preview piece for the game on Saturday and also my match report, in the sense that it felt like none of this actually matters in the slightest, because England are just going to absolutely walk their group. And I mean, even if they try and use these games to train the team, the difference between these matches and the matches that are probably going to be able to come in the quarterfinal, semifinal of the Euros are so different.
Yeah. Well, we can get into why that might increasingly be the case, but just specifically on England, I mean, at the World Cup, Gareth Southgate played 3-5-2, or actually kind of a 3-6-1. You know, it was a three-man defence anyway with wing backs. Now it's 4-3-3, and it seems like he's going for the sort of Liverpool template. It's like he's got three pretty solid midfielders and three dynamic attackers who are. You know what I mean? It's kind of,
yeah.
So this is a conscious shift. Is this going to be the system that they bring into the championships, do you think?
Yeah, and I think this was the system he wanted to play initially, but really didn't have the players for the World Cup last year, so he had to adapt and play that system with wing-backs. But this is what he wants. He feels the defence is now suited to it and more accustomed to it. I think the front three is probably the front three that's going to stay. Unless maybe someone ousts Rashford, which would, I suppose, someone like Hudson-Odoi or Jadon Sancho, but Sterling and Kane are fixed. And it really just comes down to the midfield. The one player maybe to expect to break, that would be Oxlade-Chamberlain, well, I suppose a little bit like Liverpool. Southgate did say recently that had he been fit, he would have been a starter in the World Cup. And he does offer something different at his best. And at the best, you would imagine Klopp idealises for him. And he offers kind of proper force going forward. And that was the one thing, I suppose, about this England team on Saturday, given all the talent in it, and that's despite someone like Alexander-Arnold not starting, that it was quite a functional midfield, and he went for basically, you know, one ball winner, or primarily ball winner in Rice, and two kind of runners, different types of runners, in Henderson and Barkley, where he does have a lot more of the passers that they have been missing in the past. So maybe I think that's probably the area of the team that will evolve the most, or the one he'll certainly experiment with the most, because the rest of it seems pretty fixed.
Yeah, I
remember I did something with maybe this is interesting from an alternative history perspective, but I did something with Tim Sherwood recently.
Oh, yeah.
who was going on about how he thinks Southgate should just completely switch that midfield and use Foden as a six and have Madison and Grealish ahead of him, basically have an entirely kind of, you know, technical pass based.
What, just boot Declan Rice out and bring in Jack Grealish? Like, what's he? Yeah. What's he on about?
Yeah.
Why Phil Foden as a number six? I mean, why not?
His rationale was we're just going to see so much more technique to the team, make them more fluid, because they can maybe be a bit boxy in the middle. And like that midfield, I suppose, is where they've been most exposed. If you go back to that Dutch game in June, which I was at, again, it was was a little bit of a classic old problem for England. It was the same in the Croatia game, where gradually they were they just ceded control in the middle of the pitch because they don't have a passer. So, yeah. I mean, there was logic to what he was saying. And I mean, good as Rice is, he's not going to give you that kind of De Jong control in the middle.
No, but he's a big, strong guy. He gets it and gives it. Like, you know, not everybody. I mean, England don't have a Frankie De Jong. I mean, Phil Foden is not a Frankie De Jong.
But this is going to be the primary challenge. It's probably what the Euro is going to come down to. It's solving that problem of how they ultimately get done by teams who do have a Frankie De Jong. And it feels like, I think, pretty much all the top teams do.
Ah, no, they don't. This is an eternal... Who else is a midfielder like that? I mean, you could say that Modric was that type of player. You know, he's pretty old.
Spain still have Thiago.
Thiago.
I mean... The French actually do use Pogba in a more measured way like that, and it kind of comes off. But ultimately, they're all better passers than what England have got. The Belgium use De Bruyne in that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think Rice has got quite a simple job. I mean, it's interesting that Rice has already sort of taken over Henderson's old job. I mean, from the World Cup and the couple of seasons before, that's what Henderson was doing in the England team. You know, he was the kind of base midfielder. And obviously, he no longer does that for Liverpool. He's been moved out there for England. Rice, I guess, is kind of an indispensable player to them. Now, I mean, obviously, Tim Sherwood's idea notwithstanding, he does look like the outstanding kind of number six type of midfielder they have. What do you think Grealish's chances actually are of getting into this? Because he seems like a kind of quite complementary player in the sense of as an eight, you know, if England are going to play the two eights, he does have the ability to carry the ball and to sort of pick passes. But despite playing pretty well for Villa over the last few seasons, really, he's never really... they've never been interested since they actually seduced him. He's simply been cast aside. Yeah. It's a sad story.
I mean, at the time, event at the other show, I did ask him about Grealish, I suppose, would he ever regret not having switched for Ireland? Because for us now, we'd have 10, 15 caps, probably good enough to transform us into... Well, aside, they can turn one-all draws into maybe 2-1, 1-0 wins.
Absolutely. Imagine we had the two of them.
Whereas Sherwood kind of made the argument that ultimately he did always really want to play for England. But the issue is, I mean, for Grealish, it's going to come down to impact in the Premier League. But there's a question of whether he can make the impact, because he's much better in a team that will have more of the ball. I suppose this is related to the Ireland question as well. But... And that's where, and the more a team has the ball, the more attack, the more actually he excels, which is why he thinks that really it would have been so much better for him to go to Spurs when he had the chance, because he would have gone on to another level with them. And I suppose in this England team, it excel as well. But there's going to be a bit of that gap for the moment because of what Villa are and the way they're probably going to struggle a little bit, and because of the type of football they play and what is best for Jack Grealish. So we might, it could be only a season where we see him kind of in fits and starts in Premier League in terms of his actual impact, which probably won't be, given the amount of talent that England have,
yeah.
You'd imagine won't be enough to get him into a Euro 2020 squad. But another thing that was mentioned about Grealish, though, was also that we could be talking about modern Letiz here, in the sense that he really is a bit of a hometown boy, loves playing for Villa, and, you know, I mean, not quite loves being a big fish in a small pond, but he relishes his role in that Villa team.
Yeah, well, I wish there were more like him, rather than everybody trying to join the same two or three teams. Can I ask you just quickly before we move on to Bulgaria, because they obviously are coming to Dublin tomorrow, and I'm very interested to hear your impressions of what kind of a test they're going to provide for Ireland. But what's the story with Rashford? I mean, Southgate kind of talked about him a bit afterwards, sort of in the encouraging way in which Southgate criticizes people. he kind of made some points about what he'd like to see Rashford doing, I guess implying that he wasn't really doing enough of them. But he is a player. I mean, I know you said you think this is going to be the front three going to Euros, but his place in the team does seem vulnerable to me in a way that Sterling certainly isn't, and Harry Kane's probably isn't either. Given that they've got Jadon Sancho, who had such an amazing season last year. So I wonder, how does Rashford stay ahead of him? Because, you know, Manchester United are using him now as a centre forward, and Southgate was saying after this game, he thinks he's not really a centre forward.
Yeah, he described him as a wide raider where he was his best work. And you're right in that sense about how Southgate speaks. Because even when, like, afterwards we're talking about how to frame the news line around what Southgate said. You can't really say Southgate challenges, because that's not what Southgate does in that regard. Mm. But he did kind of talk at length about how, you know, maybe there's all this discussion about Rashford's nine, but maybe where he's happiest and where he's done his best work is out wide. And of course, that's where the penalty came from for Kane's second goal. There's that pace as well. And I suppose part of the issue here is, maybe this could be a bit self-serving from Souke as well, in the sense that no one's going to dislodge Harry Kane from that team anytime soon. He is the fixed number nine. So if Rashford wants to be in the England team, you know, concentrate on what works best for us. Maybe a bit of subtle conditioning from Souke. It's hard not to disagree with him, maybe. I'm sorry, hard not to agree with him. There's still maybe something lacking in Rashford's finishing. Most of his most electric moments, and where you see the player where everyone's talked about potentially, or where everyone gets excited about, is when he suddenly makes those breaks out wide, cutting in, and he often has the kind of defences running scared of him when he starts to run at them.
Yeah, well, you know, it is kind of a bit weird though, isn't it? I mean, just if you look at what's happened with Raheem Sterling, who's now got 7 in his last 7 for England, having kind of struggled to score for them for a year. I mean, I think he had 2 goals before this. In 40-45 matches maybe, and then 7 in 7. So we have seen this with players before. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo is a great example. The way that he was a solid 4-goal-a-season man for a couple of years at Manchester United. Didn't score in the Champions League for like his first 20 matches or something. And then just started scoring a goal a game and has kept that up. Like, it's something kind of clicks. You know, maybe this is something that could happen with Rashford as well.
It does feel like they've got different qualities in that way. I mean, think what everyone says about Sterling, where it really clicked for him was almost, and not to give too much credit, I suppose, to Guardiola for something, obviously Sterling has himself, but he clearly helped. It was basically just the positional understanding of shape, that previously Sterling had been quite a boxy player, since he moved in, despite his dribbling, positionally he moved in straight lines, whereas kind of Guardiola helped him to understand how to move into space to create the most damage. And this comes back to something I find increasingly interesting in modern football. The players are basically, they're given almost like NFL quarterback levels of instructions that they have to take in, particularly the level of Guardiola. But obviously this is something that Sterling has taken on a lot, that he instinctively, after a lot of education, a lot of coaching education, knows where to move now. And it's kind of brought all these levels of his game together.
Yeah.
I thought
I thought one moment in the game that really showed that up was England's first goal, where Bulgaria were trying to play it out from the back, you know, and the defenders were inside the box in this kind of, on the face of it, ridiculous, you know, but okay, they're doing this. And to watch Sterling... the way that he waits to pounce on that defender when he sees the goalkeeper is going to play the ball to him. Sterling gets to the ball first. I mean, it's a bad pass anyway. But he's kind of completely aware or alive to this situation and waiting for his moment to run in a way that tells you, like, okay, he's a super switched on player at all times, but he's also learned a lot of this type of stuff, I guess, from playing in a team like City.
Yeah, completely. And even with that goal, there was a real element of basically the bigger kids realizing with the little kids they were so much better. They could just wait to pounce. Mm. I suppose that being distilled through Sterling, but yeah, completely. And he just has that complete awareness now to the point. I mean, it's almost like that. For years when Germany were at their best, I suppose between around 2012 to 2016, one of the things that they talked about a lot in kind of coaching circles was this: someone like Müller just knew where to run. He knew the kind of single dart he could make that would instantly take 4 players out of the game. And that's basically what Sterling has appropriated. And an example of that was that first goal on Saturday, if in a different way. He just knew exactly where to be and exactly what to do.
What about Bulgaria, Miguel? How impressed were you with the Bulgarians? Do you think can they subject the Ireland defence to some Bulgar heat?
They were shocking. And even that moment kind of summed it up, because basically this is a team who'd come to Wembley completely understandably looking to play a restrictive kind of defensive game because there's a huge quality gap. And yet then they immediately go against all that with passing out from the back for that goal kick and get caught because they don't really have the quality to do it. And like it was, I mean, when you look at England, I suppose the nature of international football is now you kind of forget about a lot of these games and these teams until basically the week comes around and you have to get immersed in it again. Mm. And like, you know, so for weeks you're thinking, you know, you've got England, Bulgaria on the horizon. England, Bulgaria, judging from the way we've grown up, that is at the very least an awkward fixture for England. Then in attempting to do a preview piece for it and all that, started to look through the squad. And I was genuinely like quite surprised by the level of it. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a Moldova of the 90s style level size.
Yeah.
That's how bad Bulgaria sank. It's difficult even to say where of those that have left Bulgaria. I think it's about eight of them. Of the clubs they play, it's difficult even to say who's the best or whether that term is even appropriate. I think one's at Gil Vicente, one at Yekaterinburg, one of the third tier of Germany. So it's a significant drop off from the teams everyone remembers from Bulgaria. I suppose the first memory is Stoichkov and the 94 side, then maybe a decade later with Berbatov. But this is part of a wider pattern, particularly in Eastern European football, which is a connected inverse of what's happening with the big, wealthy Western European countries. It's something that's been touched on a lot in David Goldblatt's new book, The Age of Football, which argues that football has never been more popular, that it trumps basically any other cultural pursuit in history, that it crosses more borders than even kind of the music of Elvis. But because it's also embraced ultra-capitalism like nothing else, it means all the money in the game naturally just concentrates in a handful of the wealthiest European countries. And that's why I suppose what we're seeing, which is maybe for the first time in history, that all of the wealthiest countries are actually the best in international football. England, Germany, France, Spain, the Dutch. Yeah. But the rise of those countries is also directly connected to the drastic fall of countries like Poland, Bulgaria, Romania. Although Romania are enjoying a little bit of a resurgence that are on 21 side, but even one of the stories I heard about them indicates one of the problems here, in that I was talking to someone who was saying that they were trying to punt on. I was talking to an agent who was told that they were trying. He'd been approached about a potential deal for one of the under 21 players. That player had something like 12 people claiming to represent them. It was almost impossible to untangle.
Yeah,
and with the issue there being ultimately corruption, and this is the thing. What has happened connected to all the money going elsewhere in the game with disincentivizing kind of talent programs or collective talent programs, there's been nothing to replace the disintegration of the old kind of Soviet structures that did prop up and really enhance the talent in these countries for so long.
Yeah.
And what has replaced is corruption almost.
And the one,
and what we're seeing now is the after effects of that.
And the one country in this region that's actually doing really well at the moment is England's next opponent, Kosovo, who you get to see them. You get to see them, is it tomorrow night? I think they're playing in Southampton. And the interesting thing about Kosovo is that if you think back 20 years, there was, you know, the war there, the NATO bombing of Serbia, massive refugee flows, and lots of these Kosovar players. I mean, there's obviously the Swiss national team has got a couple of the real Kosovo stars in Shaqiri and Xhaka. Well, actually, I'm not sure if Xhaka is Kosovar, but Shaqiri is certainly of that background. But the current Kosovo team consists of quite a few players who were swept up in this and grew up, and I guess were then trained and educated as footballers in Western countries.
Yeah, I was talking to a Kosovan journalist yesterday who made that exact point that, and one of the reasons are their levels above everyone else in this group. I mean, the Czechs are another example of a team that has sort of a really drastic fall. Kosovo beat them at the weekend, and it's because they've received the benefit of Western training. And Selke actually mentioned as well on Saturday how, this is quite damning of Bulgaria in itself, yeah, it'll be a very, very different game on Tuesday, as if these are actually a good team. But he also mentioned how that talent is well amplified by the kind of the intensity of focus that comes basically from extreme patriotism of a new campaign, a new country, looking to kind of make a name for it to mark itself out. And Selke did, he's watched them a lot. He said they really remind them, not so much in this level of talent, to be fair, but in terms of what they are as a team, how cohesive they are and how fervent they are, to Croatia 96.
Yeah.
And England, I mean, for all we've spoken, like, England will win tomorrow, I'd say. But it could be maybe the awkward test you would have expected from something like Bulgaria.
Absolutely. Well, Miguel, I hope you enjoy the game as much as we enjoyed speaking to you today.
Thank you.
Marcelo. Right foot across from him. Bale. Target. Are you serious? Are you serious? Gareth Bale just on the pitch. One of the best goals you'll ever see in a Champions League final.
Marcelo.
Et qui va pouvoir centrer maintenant la reprise. Oh, la goal de Gareth Bale. Couillou. Mamma mia.
That's a fairly downbeat assessment from Miguel of our opponents tomorrow night, Ken.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, obviously in friendlies, very few people are paying much attention to the opposition. I think I'll probably be the same. You know, the interesting thing from my point of view is which of these players that comes in is going to look as though they could maybe make a difference in our team. You know, that's what the game is all about. So hopefully someone at least will have a good game.
We'll have a football show on Wednesday directly after that Ireland-Bulgaria game. And we've another show coming out later today as Ireland sets sail for Japan and the Rugby World Cup. But in the meantime, thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Kara.
And thanks, Megan, for listening.
The storm is happening. That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home.